Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today. Hey, fam. Welcome back for part two of our chat with neuroscientist Uma Chatterjee as we continue our conversation on the neurobiology of the OCD brain. Our chat explores what's happening on a neurobiological level when we experience fight, flight, or freeze, stigma-breaking conversation around psychedelics research, and strategies for helping folks filter out good science in a world where journals and funding talks. Intrigued? I hope so. Because this learning is powerful, and I can't wait for you to hear more. I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started. Okay, fam. Okay. Hello. How's it going? I'm here. Actually, I'm more than here. I'm excited to be back for part two with our amazing guest, Uma Chatterjee. And to be quite honest, fam, I planned on bringing this part two to you last week, but let's have a quick little story time, shall we? So my husband and I haven't been out on a date in a hot minute. And sometimes we'll grab a lunch together while the kids are at school, but I can't even remember the last time we had a sitter for an actual date. So we got the bright idea, I know, to do just that, which, hey, for all intents and purposes, it was a good idea. But on our way out, before we did a single thing, we got rear-ended. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just say, we're all fine. The driver was fine. He had two of his sweet kiddos in his car. They're totally fine. I'm fine. Patrick's fine. We're all fine. And just by looking there at the damage done, to the naked eye, it appeared to be a really minor situation. The bumper looked scuffed and a bit askew, I guess. But you would have never known we were just rear-ended, which was actually pretty amazing considering the impact. Now, I bring up this accident for two reasons. Number one, my own OCD has always had a strong narrative about car accidents, car anxiety, car danger. So for any newer fam joining, if you're like, did she just say she has OCD? I thought she treats it and then she does this pod about OCD. Yes, yes to all the things. And while I've never had the hit and run version of OCD, which is a very common subtype, I've definitely had the I might could possibly get hit by a car version of OCD. And it's plagued me really since I was a kid. So I'm usually a hypervigilant barrel of fun in the car. Although I will say my own OCD work and better understanding of anxiety sensitivity has helped me to chill considerably over the years. SSRIs don't hurt with that either, just gonna say. But we got rear-ended, and I have to say, I did really well with it. Like, in no universe would I recommend going out and being rear-ended on purpose to prove to yourself you could do it. But a big silver lining for me after this car accident was that I haven't been in a car accident, and it's been a hot minute. 20 years at this point, at least. And it really wasn't bad. Even with a hard hit, I was calm as a cucumber. Like, yes, we got hit. Yes, that sucks. But also, it wasn't bad. It wasn't great. I'm not like, yeah, a car accident, but it really wasn't bad. And my husband was a bit shocked, I think, because I was pretty casual about it. I was like, yeah, no, it's okay. We're all right. Make sure everybody was okay. That helped considerably. But
yeah, it was like, no biggie.
And from an exposure and response prevention lens, which we also refer to as ERP around these parts, I experienced an exposure in real time, whether I wanted to or not, in vivo, and I didn't engage in any of my compulsions. And I was fine. My husband was fine. The gentleman and his children were fine. It was an inconvenience, but my nervous system and my brain, the organ of interest, our topic for today, learned something important. So while I would never in the name of ERP be like, yeah, go do that, I could definitely appreciate that what my brain gleaned from the experience was that response prevention learning in real time. So there is the positive from the car accident. Okay. On the flip side, the second reason I bring this up is that after talking to his insurance and our insurance and getting our car to the insurance contracted garage and getting it evaluated for repair and all that fun jazz, we got a call telling us that our vehicle was actually totaled. Boo. And that was disappointing, to say the least. So while the exterior looked shockingly fine, I might even describe the appearance of the bumper as, I don't know, swollen. It appeared fairly normal. Apparently, the accident caused major damage to the frame. And if you open the trunk, it was pretty tore up from the floor up, if I do say so myself. Which made sense thinking back again to how hard we were hit, because it was astounding when visually the damage was virtually non-existent. We're like, what? We got hit pretty hard. It looks fine. But I guess the frame crumpled into a big mess and needed to be completely replaced amongst other things. And by the time they got the evaluation out, the repairs would cost more than the actual value of the car. So they called that a total loss. And so now we're trying to work out that piece. And it's just a big pain in the ass, if I'm being completely honest. So we had talks with mechanics and car insurance agents or adjusters or whoever they are, and talks about comps and evaluations of repairs. And this took up a pretty big chunk of my week last week. And honestly, we're still problem solving it this week. We still have our rental car. We're still, I don't know, my husband's taking the lead on most of that, but it's still a bit of a mess. But that experience is what ultimately helped me make the call last week that life was lifing just a little too much, and I needed to press pause. So I shot Uma a message. Our part two would be coming out this week. So I just wanted to provide some context to you guys, and Uma was graciously understanding. But yeah, sometimes life is just gonna life, and you gotta go, hey, I might have had some plans for us, but life had other plans. So that's my car story. It's an OCD win, and honestly, maybe even a recovering perfectionist win for me to be like, yeah, I can prioritize balance. But also, I wanted to mention another win for our award-winning guest because Uma was busy last week as well. So on March 7th, that was last Friday, Uma participated in the Stand Up for Science 2025 rally at the Wisconsin State Capitol. As she shared about in our last episode, part one of this series, she has lived experience of OCD and other co-occurring psychiatric and medical health issues. And in her own words, she described how she is alive because of science. Science that has developed evidence-based treatments and saved her life. And not only that, but she has been empowered to become a neuroscientist herself, bringing purpose and meaning and helping to pave a way for other people to get relief and hope for their futures. So well done, Uma. I thought that was pretty cool and worthy of some recognition and just wanted to note that. Also, because I know y'all, if you listen to part one, you are on cliffhanger status. I'm sure, just waiting to find out, did I do my behavioral experiment from last episode? Did I try the sweetened coffee? Did I like it? And I'm here to tell you, I did try it. I did. I tried it later in the day with some decaf, and judge me if you must. I get it. But I have to report, I did not like it. Mm-mm. It was not my thing. Now, I did try this experiment, but once. And we know really good science is replicated and tested under different conditions. And again, we were just kind of having a little fun after last episode and practicing different behavioral experiments we can try in our own lives. But while I am confident that I do like espresso martinis, yum, or tiramisu, sweetened coffee as the drink itself, yeah, it's not my thing, fam. It's not for me.
So if you're like, what's all this coffee talk about, and you missed part one of the episode, I would suggest, first of all, pausing here, not just for the coffee part, but for my chat with Uma, laying a really nice foundation for the neurobiology of the OCD brain, or what we know at least. It's so important. It's really interesting, and I think it'll be really helpful for springboarding us into today's conversation. So if you haven't heard that, pause, check it out, and then come back, because we have more really great conversation to be had. Okay, so with that, just a quick reminder about Uma, our wonderful guest, and then we're going to dive right back into it. So Uma, our neuroscientist in doctoral training, our science communicator and mental health advocate, is the president of OCD Wisconsin, an affiliate of IOCDF, with whom she is also a peer advocate. In addition to being on podcasts and actually having her own pod, she also is really busy giving talks and presentations, doing research, and, you know, getting her PhD. She's very open about her lived experience of OCD, comorbid psychiatric disorders, and being a cancer survivor, as you'll hear a little bit more about in our chat today. But above all of that, she also is very open and candid about how she is still working on her own treatment. That's right, treatment. Because we know cures don't exist for a lot of these conditions. In fact, she penned in response to her participation in last week's Stand Up for Science March that she's on two lifelong daily cancer meds, receives treatment 3 times weekly for psychiatric disorders, and works hard to manage her illnesses with the tools that science has given her. And I have to say, Uma, I have heard really positive feedback from our part one, but even a client was mentioning to me this past week on how moved they were at hearing your story. They were like, yes, it was so debilitating, but yes, look at where she is now. And yes, she's still in treatment. And I think sometimes people can hear that and go, oh my gosh, will I ever be able to not be in treatment? Sure, I think that can happen. But also, there's no shame being in treatment, especially if it's giving you the tools and support to live your life. So I know my client was really moved, and I know so many family members here listening are moved as well. So we're going to build upon that incredibly powerful conversation, Uma's powerful life experience, to dive back in for part two of this chat. Because fam, as much as we've discussed, there's so much more to talk about. So let's get to it. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And we have back with us today, we have Uma Chatterjee. So glad to have you back for a second episode. This is so helpful. And we have just loved having this conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much.
We talk about often here in the community how in OCD, a lot of times there are these false alarms going off in the brain where we're driven into that survival instinct. We're in fight, flight, or freeze. And so can we talk a little bit more about what's happening on a neurobiological level when that's occurring?
Absolutely. I think this is a great time to bring back the cortical striatal thalamic cortical loop. It's just the general like framework upon which like you can overlay exactly that. And what I want to say, just in terms of what I've heard so much in the community, is like people often love to bring up, for example, the amygdala, because that's something that's been sensationalized in like the media and just talking about like the fear center of the brain. And it makes sense for people who especially, again, want to like sort of pan their symptoms onto a biological construct to then validate that their disorder is real. And I'm saying it's real. And I'm also saying that like, I didn't mention the amygdala in that circuit. And that does not mean the amygdala is not relevant or impacted by or driving, in a sense, any part of what we experience as OCD. But it's more of a downstream effect from the cortical striatal thalamic loop. But all that to say, I just wanted to bring that up front because people often, they're like, what about the amygdala, before I even get to explaining the circuit? But essentially, when you talked about this over salience of threats, right? This over salience of uncertainty, of doubt, of fear, of disgust, of many different parts of OCD, which I think is also important to bring up because so often people think it's just a hyper form of anxiety. And for a lot of people, right, they, you know this, like people experience anxiety, but sometimes people don't. Like there are other emotions or other driven, you know, in terms of just right, in terms of
disgust.
Yeah. And yes, there's like a later element sometimes of like anxiety as a response to that, but it's not like the original or right. originating.
Primal. It's not the first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and so that, you know, sort of reconciles the fact that this overarching brain structure is just basically like taking thoughts and cues and adding tags to it, or just like giving too much attention to their importance. And it's just it's a wrong prediction, essentially. And so that's in a sense where this circuit starts. Although I will say there's a lot of research trying to figure out in this circuit, I'm about to say, like, where can you intervene in the circuit to break it? And for that, it could be different for different people. But so for the purposes of just explaining the time scale of like how an obsession leads to a compulsion and then reinforces the obsession, I'm talking about it in an order. But in terms of how we intervene, that order has not been established. So just putting that out there.
Yeah.
So we have the cortical element. And when I say that, that's just a very broad term for many parts of the frontal cortex. There's things like the prefrontal cortex, and you can subdivide, and especially in the work I do with like the medial versus the lateral versus the whatever. There's also the orbital front. There's just so many parts of the cortex, but essentially we're talking about the cortex, and parsing all that out is like a decade worth of work. Anyway.
Like too long, don't read. That's just how it works. Okay.
unless you're me and then do that every day. I'm just like, when will people go to sleep is always like the work I'm trying to figure out as a site communicator versus what do people want to know?
Yeah.
And then that part of the brain is communicating to what I was talking about earlier, the striatum, the motor coordination typically of like, do we act upon these thoughts? Because essentially that's what we're doing all the time. Like we're having thoughts and we're like, what do we do about them? And it's so passive. It feels like an automatic thing. And it is an automatic thing most of the time. And especially when you encounter something like a new obsession and then you start doing behaviors, it does become automatic. And that's part of that process too. We're naturally going to respond to some wild thing that goes on in our head that our brain's telling us is super important, that we're having that primal response to, as you said. And so there's, on a high level, this imbalance between the ability to act upon something versus inhibit our action towards something. And because of that, it creates hyperexcitability where we're doing too much, where we're not able to inhibit and recognize we don't need to actually act upon this thing. So we're doing more of that behavior. And so that's signaling to the thalamus, which is a very lower brain structure. It's much more part of where we evolved from. And it's really the thalamus at large is like gating a lot of things like our autonomic nervous system and our breath. And do we need to, you know, upregulate blood and just different things that keep us alive? Right. But essentially, when we're having those thoughts, we're acting on it. And then there's this deeper part of our brain that's like recognizing that this is all relevant to survival. And so we need to reinforce this back to let our brain know that we need to keep doing this so we don't have to make this decision factor again. So a lot of people report like, right, they had this intrusive thought and then they did this behavior and then they just kept doing it. And that's essentially that process. And so it just becomes like a repetitive loop that keeps going and going, and it's hyper excitable. And this can apply to literally any intrusive thought that falls under the sun, or any obsession that falls under the sun, of just that general feeling. And I know people with OCD can talk about, like, they all explain it differently, but it's that feeling that they're just like, it doesn't matter. No logic, no reason, no nothing. It's just but that dread or that doubt, or even though they know it's true, but what? Like, it's exactly that. And so there's, again, like 50,000 hours more to parse that all out and describe. There's so many parts of like that. There's microcircuitry, there's different types of cells, there's different projections that are co-occurring at the same time. But I'm just more broadly speaking to the regions that are on a high level communicating with each other.
Yeah. So in some ways, when we describe having those thought loops, it's exactly that. Like, and on a neurobiological level, there's actually those thought loops. And so being able to go, okay, actually, we're onto something there, and understanding how that is spiraling. But again, like you said, and something that I want to kind of remind everybody listening is that there is hope, because the brain is responsive and changing, ever changing, in response to different actions, different thoughts, different, you know, I think a perfect example for any of those in the Midwest or the East Coast or other parts of the world where you're dealing with some of the weather-related issues, whether it's ice or mudslides or whatever, that if you slip on the ice, then you're going to learn next time, oh, I think I maybe am going to be more cautious, right? Or I'm going to hold on to this railing, or I'm going to take slower steps, etc. And so our brain is still learning and able. It's not because we have these loops that we're kind of screwed, because this is going to be a self-reinforcing cycle on its own without intervention. What's going to cause it to change? I mean, there isn't going to be something to change. It's a circuit and it's going to keep going, but it is responsive to learning
as you were saying. And so being able to understand the impact of that is really important.
100%. I love that you said this too, because it just makes me really sad when people, because just a general lack of understanding of our brain, right? I'm not blaming it, but it makes me sad when people talk about therapy being sort of secondary to like medication, or like it's just a, you know, you're just, it's like sort of a frilly side benefit to feel like you're doing something about your condition when actually you just need to like get brain surgery or something, or like take, you know, drugs. And it's like they all are intervening with those circuits. And actually, it, you know, one of the most powerful ways to do that, should your brain have the capacity, because everyone's different, is literally to change your actions, change your actions. That's like the crux of the reconciliation of many of the treatments we have available to us that are established and that are supporting people and emerging even. Like it's changing their behaviors and, you know, not giving our thoughts so much power, which sounds so simple, but that literally changes your brain. And yeah, for different people, that might mean some people are able to intervene with those behaviors more and then they have less intrusive thoughts or obsessions, and that's cool. Some people don't. I haven't. I still apparently have the same amount of obsessions. I just like am able to interact with them less. But whatever the case is, I'm changing something and thus I have my life back. So it is extremely powerful. And all we're doing in the world of treatment is trying to figure out, how do we intervene with this? And like, how many different ways can we come up with to attend to the wide variety of people and the biodiversity that exists in terms of, like I said, where do we interrupt that circuit from and what works best for what people?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just participated recently in a metacognitive therapy training, and one of the things that they were talking about was recognizing the controllability, or in the frame of uncontrollability, when we think like we don't have a choice in being able to respond differently. And so many people with OCD can empathize. It feels like an involuntary response, a lot of these urges and compulsions. And in that circuit, it is very hard to create a different reaction or think that you have the ability to create a different reaction. But the difference of awareness versus engagement in the action, and, you know, when we think of cognitive behavioral therapy, or we think about something specifically like exposure and response prevention, the response prevention is preventing, very simply stated, preventing that response, doing something different. And then the brain is, we're noticing having this learning as a response, just like grabbing onto the railing or walking slowly on the icy path. And so it's very interesting to learn about the impact of how that can make such a profound difference. Medication, and I don't know, this might be an oversimplification, but, you know, one of the ways I think about it is, it's turning down the noise and intensity around maybe some of those loops so that it can be easier to create some of the change. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be on medication to make change. It doesn't mean that therapy alone, like you were saying, can't create that change. But sometimes when it's at such a screaming fever pitch, it is very, very difficult. And, you know, part of where we started in conversation, you were talking about, even in your own journey, how being on the wrong medications or having the wrong diagnoses or having the wrong treatment can then make such a profound impact, right? Because our brain is learning, and sometimes that's just going to make that brain loop even more intense.
That's exactly what happened to me. Like in retrospect, looking back at like all of the different therapies that I was just sitting there and doing compulsions and being told and encouraged to do what they did not know was a compulsion, and just, you know, constantly seeking reassurance, constantly doubting my memory, constantly avoiding and whatever. And it just being like validated as like an actual, like just a trauma response that's like worth it, or just like, you know, feeling like I was just insecure, so they needed to keep telling me that what I was thinking is true. Like, that's just hardened in my head. Like, I need to keep asking. And I literally never felt satisfied, ever.
Yeah. All right, fam. If you're getting value out of our conversation, but you haven't hit subscribe or followed OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts and YouTube, please take a moment, no time like the present, to hit that button. It's free, it's easy, and it ensures that not only will you never miss an episode, but that more folks can find the OCD Family community. Because fam, we know we're better together. Now, back to today's chat. You know, I think zooming in a bit more to this idea too on research and how this works with psychedelics, because what I was thinking about as you were sharing that, and it's kind of, you know, adjacent to it in my mind, is
you and I were talking before recording about past IOCDF conferences. And what I will say, a theme in the last couple of years that I've noticed is a really strong interest in understanding and at almost every medication or psychiatric, like if there was a psychiatrist on the panel or if there was a neuroscientist on the panel, people were like, so tell me about the psychedelics. Tell me about psilocybin. Tell me about MDMA. Tell me about what's going on. And if you don't have context for this, this is like, well, these are like these explicit drugs. Tell me about ketamine. Tell me about these things, right? And we've had stories. There was a big legal case for somebody on ketamine, a case for Maya, I think it was. And so the stigma in the mind is like, you want to make explicit drugs okay and say that this is going to be research-based. And I feel like that's pretty dismissive of the argument overall and the research, but I think it also just points to the lack of understanding. And so I don't think that people are necessarily trying to be dismissive, but they're trying to go like, well, maybe I even have a hard time considering taking an SSRI. I'm not going to take mushrooms. What are you talking about when it comes to some of this research? And then there's another camp that's like, I am not going to do exposure. I can't. I'm terrified. I'm surviving. I'm hanging on. When are the shrooms coming? Because I know that they're coming. And again, I don't want to dismiss like the amount of pain. I want to validate that they're really, really struggling and that there is some really promising research happening when it comes to psychedelics. And it's a part of the conversation that is still a little bit controversial to talk about. Mm-hmm. As they're working particularly on more different research studies on this, but even the research studies in and of themselves, people that have participated in clinical trials have faced some backlash when they've admitted they've been a part of a clinical trial. And I would love if we can talk a little bit more about what you're finding with the research happening in psychedelics.
That taboo, that stigma is just something that has been so interesting to start in many ways my career off with, because I came into advocacy, came into research with lived experience of OCD and lived experience of multiple of these, call it whatever you want, call them substances, drugs, medications, whatever people call it, medicine, like whatever the case is. I came in with that because I experienced firsthand. And again, this is anecdotal, so this is not research-based. This is me talking as a person, but how it informed my research interests of how on earth these compounds that have been in my head told to me are poison or so bad or going to ruin people's lives. Like, but I was at rock bottom for, I didn't even get into this part of my story, but I was diagnosed with cancer. I still live with it. I was at massive rock bottom in so many ways. And the amount that those compounds, in my end of one anecdotal perspective, helped me to engage with treatment and make meaningful progress for the first time in my life. And my phenomenological experience was so different on them versus like the euphoria and joy that so many people respond to these drugs with. Like, I was just like, well, I need this. I need to understand both what's going on like a biological level of the disorder and what on earth these drugs are doing. And is that interacting with the actual pathology of the disorder? Is it doing something completely different? What on earth is going on? And so it really led me as a person and as someone seeking funding and research and legitimacy in this very seemingly taboo field and stigmatized field still, to understand that these are just compounds, many of them naturally occurring out in the world that people were taking. And for a whole host of reasons, there was a drug war. We don't need to get into it. There's so much education out there in the world, but research that was really promising back in the day was shut down for a whole host of reasons. And it was so undeniably powerful that eventually, sadly, way later than it should have, in my opinion, has come back. And the reason people have such an overarching stigma toward them is because they are scheduled as drugs. And that's something that people, as scientists and clinicians, are fighting every single day. Like, when they study these compounds, learn their history, and understand that they're just compounds that just do stuff in the brain. And the fact that just like anything else that's unregulated, or sometimes even correlative things, like you take a drug and then you do something wild that's illegal or bad, and people just blame it on the drug versus all of the systems that could have kept that from happening in the future. Like, they're just incredibly powerful drugs. We have no idea. Like, we have some idea of what they're doing, but there's so much more to learn. But the profound impact, most importantly, they've had on people's mental health, and it's started largely looking at people who were, it sounds really morbid, but it was most justified to look at these drugs and people who were going to die from cancer anyway. So looking at their effects, having their mortality being faced and experiencing extreme depression and anxiety, what even at end of life, these drugs, and by these drugs, I'm talking about a whole host of them. Some of them technically are psychedelics like psilocybin, DMT, ibogaine, and some of them are not actually psychedelics in terms of their neurobiology, but we lump them into that word, broadly speaking, because we're talking about psychoactive drugs, things like MDMA, ketamine, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And MDMA, you don't even like hallucinate, that's a sidebar. Anyway, so from there, so much research has been sprouted. And I think it's the fact that it's sprouted in spite of being Schedule I drugs, in spite of having such a stigma, the fact that they're happening at the top research universities with some of the most respected people in the field that are putting their, in many ways, their career on the line studying something that is has such a stigma against them is truly a testament to how much potential there is. At the same time, nobody, me nor anybody else in the field, are claiming that this is going to be the magic pill or the cure for a condition or the one thing anyone needs. Like, we are just trying to expand our toolbox of what is available to help people. And this is one potentially powerful thing that also has side effects, that also doesn't work for some people. And we have to flesh that all out and figure out what's best for who, just like we have to do that with all the drugs we currently administer for people. But at the end of the day, they're just drugs. Like, there's a whole philosophical or, you know, religious and spiritual element that people can hold, and that's for another conversation for other people. But in the context of talking about within the medical system we live in, They're just drugs that happen to, in many people, induce a big experience while they're on said drug. But we're working to figure out how much does that experience seem to inform therapeutic benefit versus it's just a side effect of the drug, but really everything that's coming after is what's actually helping, like how much it induces synaptic plasticity and metaplasticity and things like that in the brain. Like, it's just, it's amazing. Like, there's so much to be learned about it. That's why if you come to the IOCDF conference in the last 2 years, I've chaired a panel called Psychedelics and OCD. Like, it's just, it's a fully research and clinical driven conversation with a touch of humanity about where the field is. And you will hear the humbling response from people you can trust, people who have done this for 40 to 50 years and have studied things far beyond psychedelics, that it's just, we're just trying to look for what can help people. So,
yeah, you know, it makes me think. As with many things, it's easy to lose the forest through the trees if you zoom in on too much of a granular level and you go, okay, so there's drug crises across a lot of different countries and whatnot. And anything that is abused or taken in excess or not used in a therapeutic way, yeah, it can end up being dangerous. But I think about it, and maybe you tell me if I'm off on my kind of, again, my analogy of processing this, it kind of makes me think of stimulant medication, right? Stimulant medication is a scheduled medication, again, that is going to be closely monitored and people can use it to make illicit drugs and whatnot. But also, stimulant medication is extremely effective in helping people with attention deficit disorder and probably in other ways that I'm not even aware of medically across the board. But stimulant medications can have really powerful effects. And I can tell you, you know, for example, just even looking at my own children, one of my children in particular has difficulty making safe choices when they are not taking their medication because their brain is very, very busy and it's just, it's not that they don't know better, but their brain is moving really fast and then they'll make some choices and it'll end up being less safe. And so on the medication, it's completely different. And if you think about it, it's like, you know, taking a version of speed, but in a way for this person's brain, for one of my kids' brains, it actually slows down the brain and makes it so much more effective. And so there had to be a lot of different research and a lot of different testing and a lot of different things. And it has to be monitored because people can use it and sell it on the street for use, recreational use that can be addictive, etc. But also for her, it makes a huge, profound impact. And for a lot of people. And so if we had zoomed in so much on the granular level to what stimulants can do when misused or when recreationally used and in addictive ways, then their quality of life would be completely different.
And I'll take it one step further too, because there's exactly that perspective and I wouldn't change anything about it. And even specifically with, again, we said the broad class of we'll call it hallucinogens, right? That includes ketamine and MDMA that are not psychedelics. Those two have some abuse potential liability, which is far lower than most other drugs that are prescribed on a daily basis. And that can be regulated. But then what's even more fascinating to me is the classic psychedelics, for the most part, like their abuse liability and potential, like from a research standpoint, is like close to nothing. And on top of that, they're actually being studied and having profound effects to treat like all forms of addiction. Like there's name a version of a substance use disorder or any addiction disorder, and there's a trial and there's probably incredible data coming out of it. And it's interesting, I didn't know this till recently, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, like they're the NIDA, the part of the NIH, their top funding priority is psychedelics to treat drug abuse. So I just, that debunks so much of the narrative that because of stigma, because of misinformation, there's not even like an amount for most of these drugs that you can take to even overdose. So that's just biological truths. There's always also exceptions and other variables to go into it. But like, that's just even one step further from what you were saying of normalizing medications and putting them in perspective of, yes, there's abuse liability, and also they have value for the person who needs it. And it's balancing those. But then you even see that's misinformation sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's people fear what they don't know. I laugh because in the OCD field, it's like, yeah, tell me about it. But, you know, people fear what they don't know, and there's some misinformation. And if you think about it, you know, my daughter, which is the kiddo I'm talking about, we started medicating her when she was 4. And as a birth to 5 person previously, I would fight with psychiatrists that would sometimes medicate where it was like, no, I think we're using medication in place of parenting. We're, you know, they're so young, we shouldn't be using this medication. And that was naivete / privilege of not understanding the situation. Because when my daughter was very, very young, she put her head through a window. I was doing telehealth, and she put her head through a window just because she was in an impulsive space and was seeking some proprioceptive input, and she didn't mean to put her head through a window. But you look at that, she fell off of a gymnastics bar because she got distracted by something and she let go and she needed to hold on. And these are the things where I was like, we are going to lose her if we don't get her the right support. And so it sounded really controversial. And then I was like, she's not going to survive because we can't be on her 24/7. And also, what kind of quality of life would that be for us and her? But realizing like the importance of these roles and not losing the forest through the trees. Now, something that we've talked about here is the importance of recognizing misinformation, but also recognizing how a lot of people could get some kind of journal pay if they know the right people, peer reviewed, posted, and how stats can be massaged. I like the way you put that earlier. Stats can be massaged. And so what do we do with that when we're trying to go, okay, I want to have the right information. This seems like a reputable source. And how do we know which science to trust? And what tips would you have for family trying to navigate this road?
Mm-hmm. I think about this every day because it's just the way the system is set up is just frankly not accessible to the people who often care about it because of themselves or their families or, you know, just wanting to understand some subject, right? And, you know, there's a lot of gatekeeping. There's a lot of jargon. There's a lot of, like, literally, you can't access a paper beyond an abstract because you don't have institutional access. There's so much of that. But I feel like even if we remove some of those barriers, what's really missing for people is the fact that you can take the best papers, the most thorough papers, and the highest impact journals, and that's a whole complicated topic, but essentially, like, there are journals that are better than others, and our careers are often based upon publishing in some of the better journals to legitimize our work more. But even in those best case scenarios, the thing that people not doing research don't necessarily realize is, like, one paper, as impactful and, you know, even if you have like thousands of people, or in the case of genetic studies, like 50,000 people, and there's one paper that. One, like, whatever conclusion that's drawn from that paper is not a fact. And it's like not a fact in the broadest sense that it applies to everything and everyone, that we've like decided that that's the answer to this question. We're going to build upon everything we do from here from that one basis. Like, one paper does not answer anything, like, almost ever. There might be some exceptions to that, but generally speaking, one paper does not answer anything. And so, like, people tend to approach papers, like, even if they can read it, even if they use ChatGPT to translate it, whatever the hell, they take that discussion. So most of the time they jump through, they don't read actually any of the data and the raw data and the discussion. They just go to the conclusions, right? That's not information people should be like operating from, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Because the field works to collate all of that information and to retest it in different circumstances and to replicate it and to add context to it and try in different scenarios. And eventually, when something is done so many times by so many different people from so many different institutions, eventually maybe that is then decided by some bigger arbiting board of clinicians or whoever, like from generally, I'm speaking from the US, like governmental offices that decide that this is the treatment algorithm. This is where it fits in within where we start treatment, what we use, like we've decided that this is part of, this is good enough and we're going to implement this in some way, shape or form. It's safe enough. So like one trial or even like one phase three trial, people use the word phase three all the time in terms of FDA stuff. Like yeah. That's not enough for FDA approval. And so right. You could, so just my broader recommendation to people is like, it's cool to read research. I think that's great. And I love people are interested in it, but they're typically interested just to find some sort of takeaway. And like, you can find a takeaway that fits what you're looking for literally anything. Right. Like the most misinformation of all misinformation, sure, even if it's from Yeah, it's from a reputable source. Like one person from one lab could say this one thing. And like, even though they did everything right, but there's a factor they didn't realize. Like, for example, like there's construction going into the building idea. And we have to think about that a lot in terms of behavior. But someone might not have thought of like the construction stressing the animals out that I'm studying. So I might have this result that like someone else can't replicate because they don't have construction in their building, right? So where I think and hope people get information from are from people who have dedicated so much of their life to understanding how to collate that information and interpret it and then communicate it with that amount of nuance. People like science communicators, people that I say me, but I also think there are people that are far more experienced. I think what the issue is people with far more experience or people just generally in the research world don't think to actually communicate it to the people who care about them. So we're working on growing that. But Take that information from people who do this work and who can put it in perspective and seek out experts. And there's more information available now than ever. So hopefully that's changing. But Don't just read papers and assume things is what I'm saying.
Hey, real talk. If you've made it this far into the pod, chances are you love learning about OCD. So why not take it up a notch? Head over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to browse the OCD Training School's incredible lineup. And when you use my special link, you're not just investing in great education. You're also supporting this podcast at zero extra costs. With courses ranging from self-help to continuing education for clinicians, offering live and on-demand options to fit your needs or your time zone, the opportunities are vast. OCD Training School has your back. And when you use my link, you have the fam's back too. So go check it out at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And now, back to the show. One of the things I really like about the resource OCD in the Brain too is it's a community that has contributors that include researchers, but includes people with lived experience. It includes, you know, a number of different sources too. And so I love those kind of voices where it can be like scientifically checked. We see this in International OCD Foundation too. Like if you go to a conference, you're going to run across researchers and see a lot of really interesting papers and posters, presentations. But you're also going to see individuals with lived experience, family members, and practitioners contributing to the conversation there. That being said, what I will say is, and you and I were talking about this a little bit before we started recording regarding the collating of data, I have family members that are in the medical research community. I know lots of folks in the mental health research community across different areas of study. And what I will say is, you know, particularly here in the U.S., too, if I were going in, if I was going to try and get a PhD and I was going to go in and want to study a specific maybe hypothesis or scientific question, I'm a little bit at the mercy of the school that I get into and then later residency and then maybe a match, all the different things. I'm a little bit at the mercy of what's the research already ongoing in that community? You know, what is the chair of my dissert panel going to be working on and what do we have support to work on there? And so sometimes there are some emerging research that are worth more investigation and study, but it's hard to kind of break into what's already been collated and
you know, the focus is a bit narrowed there. And I think about that when I think in terms of like the study for OCD specifically, because when we think about, say, something like pseudoscience, some people might go, well, I think psychedelics are going to be pseudoscience. But actually, like, it's an emerging part of science, or something like inference-based CBT or ACT versus other treatment modalities that don't have any kind of research. But it is hard because it's kind of like breaking into a community where, well, what we have collated is already endorsing this here. And it's wonderful what they are discovering there. So I'm not poo-pooing that at all. For example, here in the States would be more of an exposure and response prevention lens. And it is an extremely good treatment and life-saving treatment for a lot of people with OCD. So I'm not shading that at all. But what would you say helping people sort out? Because you can hear conversations like, oh, but there is so much research. And you can hear another group go, it's not the right kind of research. And then there's like this ancillary, like, doo-doo kind of solution over here. And people are like, worked for me anecdotally. And we're like, ooh, these are not all the same, right? And so how do we help people sorting out and hearing about different science being done and go, what's credible? We look for that reliability and validity of their running multiple different trials. They're trying to come up with the common like outcome, right? Significant outcome. But any other advice you would have for people navigating that?
Yeah, I could spend a whole episode just talking about the biomedical research infrastructure and how complicated that is in Health Park. It's just basically all about funding. And even if you want to do research and you have the greatest idea, like, you can't do it if you don't have money. So like, it's just, so that's already like a gatekeeping element. But in terms of just at the end of the day, ascertaining like what is essentially versus what is emerging research versus what is like more established research and where to put things in perspective, I think where there's a lot of tension is when it's translating from emerging research to being established practice. And, you know, emerging research requires like not just a lot of research from one group. Take, you know, for psychedelics, like the Yale psychedelic science program, that's amazing. Like, they're doing seminal work, so many different versions of psilocybin studies and OCD. But like, it also needs to be done by like many other institutions and many other principal investigators and people that even just take that protocol or have their own protocols and try it different ways, right? So, you know, that's an example of something that's in process, that there's going to be a lot of resources needed to replicate and a lot of time and a lot of effort. And that's just unfortunately how research goes. And it's for the benefit of everyone, but of course we wish it was faster. And how sad, what do we do for the people in the meantime? And that's like a whole other thing in terms of ethics and what you do when things aren't fully established. But in terms of just putting in perspective where something is, just like you said, if there's a growing evidence base of research, that means that it's in process. And just because, in comparison to what you were saying, just because something isn't as big as something else or doesn't have as much research behind it or as many years, doesn't mean it's less worthy. It's just less studied. And that's just a fact of the matter. Like, if it's less studied, that's something you need to consider. And that's definitely, like, from an ethical perspective, like how you implement the order of treatments for people, like, that certainly matters. But it doesn't also mean that it's, you know, it has no merit or it's not going to pan out, especially if it's continually growing. So yeah, that's a short answer. Differentiating and making sure you're clear on looking at something that's an emerging treatment versus like an established treatment.
Oh, so interesting. I feel like I could talk to you forever. And I know that we are at time. I've been really interested to see, as the talk about AI, and I know AI, for especially for our existential OCD fans, are like, oh, AI. All the uncertainty, but also I'm curious in terms of how that could make some huge advancements, even in the processing work of being able to run analyses of data and findings.
Or even simulations.
Right, the simulations even. And then it's, yeah. So that could be a whole nother discussion too. Well, Emma, this was so fascinating. It was fun hanging out. And I appreciate you coming and sharing with the fam. I would love to have you back sometime, and we'll look around for you at the, I'm guessing you're going to be in Chicago for the conference this year. But you know what, fam? You can jump over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Check this episode's blog, because Emma's doing so much work all the time. It's amazing. So I continue to look forward to hearing what you have to say, because you're really speaking from multiple places of authority on this. And we just appreciate you taking the time to hang out.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Yes, we'll have to keep in touch. Intrusive thoughts.
All right. How was that? Another big thank you to our special guest, Uma Chatterjee. We got to have these two back-to-back fantastic episodes to discuss the OCD brain, neurobiology, science, and more. And like we said last episode, it is kind of magical, isn't it? Once we know how something works or is functioning, or maybe we're testing something else altogether, but by virtue of allowing ourselves to be curious and observe, we start to find these solutions or these tools or these phenomena out of the experimentation that is beneficial in ways we didn't anticipate. I mean, it gives me some Bob Ross vibes. You know what I mean, fam? Talk about a happy accident. I'm here for it. And it's exciting to consider where else science may take us, even in some of the areas that might feel a little intimidating for folks like AI or psychedelics. So thanks again, Uma. We had such a great conversation, and I'm confident the fam shares their appreciation as well. So that brings us to the intrusive thought segment, which is my application segment of the show for any newer family joining us. It's where we try to make sense of what we've heard and apply it here, now. So for today's application, in honor of the organ at the center of this all, the brain, I'm going to tip my hat, no pun intended, to an old dialectical behavioral therapy skill. Haha. So within DBT, which is a little bit less of a mouthful to say, there are a whole bunch of acronyms for different skills. One such acronym is TIP, which stands for temperature, intense exercise, paced breathing, and progressive muscle relaxation. And what TIP aims to do is to help decrease someone's emotional distress through different distress tolerance skills. But for the purposes of today's application, I'm going to stick with just the T, that temperature skill, because I think it can tie nicely in with the chat we had earlier with regards to false alarms, fight, flight, and freeze, all of that. So what is the T of TIP and why is it helpful? Well, simply said, because it's a targeted strategy to help you chill out, literally, by cooling down your body temp. Because when we get real worked up, excitable, you name it, our feelings aren't the only thing to rise. Our temperature does as well. So the method behind this madness is that by lowering your body temp, you can help activate your parasympathetic nervous system, which can then help your body calm down and rest at a neurobiological level. Translation, it helps the brain to brain in a functional way, and we love that for us. And while this can be a really helpful skill to use when you've been in a state of fight, flight, or freeze, or with respect to OCD, this trick can be helpful in a myriad of situations where we're feeling all the big feelings. So here's the simple practice for this week. During or following a time of upset or distress or frustration, whether somebody cuts you off in traffic or you get in an argument with a family member, or maybe OCD is just doing its thing and tormenting you or someone that you love. To practice the T and TIP first, number one, I want you to grab something cold. So this could be a crisp drink out of the refrigerator or a cold pack out of the freezer or maybe even some ice cubes or some ice water. And then next, I want you to hold it against your skin for approximately 30 seconds. Now, we're not trying to give ourselves freezer burn here, and we're all going to vary in how we regulate this kind of sensory input. So move it around if you need to. But you can try holding it in your hand, against your forehead, back of your neck, your wrist, over your eyes. Try it wherever you're most comfortable. And then step three, I want you to take a breath, fam. A nice breath. And just notice what that cold sensation feels like for that 30 seconds. And then finally, when that 30 seconds is complete, notice how you feel afterward. It's a simple exercise, and it's one that can be repeated until you start to feel a shift in your body. But it's also a pretty cool exercise. Get it? Cool. That can help slow down your heart rate and help yeet the intensity of those big feelings. Also, I find it helps bring attention to the here and now, baby, which, you know, makes sense. It gets us out of our imagination and right to that cold chill or that wet sensation if you have that ice water or that ice cube in your hand. Sometimes it might even provide real comfort, like, gosh, I had a sore neck or a headache and it kind of feels nice. And what I like most of all is it's fairly easy to access these tools for this sort of exercise almost anywhere you are. So whether it's splashing cool water on your face, holding a cold beverage in your hands, whatever you choose, you can help your brain do its thing. So try it out, see if it's helpful, and remember that your brain has the capacity to learn in so many different ways. You and your loved ones, me, Uma, our brains aren't broken. They are complex, they are mysterious, but they're also magical. And though life can be painful and difficult, there is always, always hope. So thanks again for joining to learn more about OCD in the brain. And thanks for being here with us, fam. Because if anything, we know that we're not alone and that we are better together. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Uma and me talking scientifically. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery Approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.